Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak with performer, playwright, author, and animator Tim Sniffen. Tim performed with and has written for the famed Second City and is a writer and director for Jackbox Games in Chicago. He performs with the Improvised Shakespeare Company and can be heard on the Hello from the Magic Tavern podcast. You can find Tim's writing online at The New Yorker and at timsniffen.com. Tim's new play, Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf, will be on stage in Buffalo at Alleyway Theater April 26th through May 18th, 2024. This hilarious comedy puts some of theater's best-known characters, like Blanche and Stanley, Salesman Willie, George and Martha, and the New England narrator in a room together for an unforgettable mashup of genre and humor. Tickets are available at alleyway.com. Tim and I talk about the fabled Hampshire College, the lessons learned from improv, and the genesis of Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf in this wide-ranging and fun conversation. Here's my interview with Tim. Tim, thank you so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
I'm good.
Fantastic.
In advance of this interview, I made sure to listen to your interviews with Paul Reiser and Disney on Ice. I tried to get a fair sampling. So they were really enjoyable. So I've been listening to you for the last 45 minutes. So it's nice to talk with you in person.
Oh, thank you. Wow. Oh, gosh. That's quite the range of interviews that I've done. But I'm one of the things I love about this position is that I'm able to talk to, you know, people from Buffalo, people who are coming through Buffalo. And so it's a really nice thing just to kind of sit down and get to ask some great questions to really interesting people.
I'm complimented to be counted among them.
Right, I'm sure. I always like to start off and ask, is there a story from your youth that connects to what you do now?
I'll tell you the first one that comes to mind, because I was born 16 years after my closest sibling. Later, my parents fully admitted, not planned. They were, you know, happy when I arrived, but not at all planned. And so I was kind of a child with parents and like two extra sets of parents, because my brother and sister were married by the time I was like five. So it was mostly me and, you know, a lot of grownups around. And I think I would do a lot of trying to entertain them at the, like, especially at dinner. And finally, at one point, my mom said, "Tim, you have to learn to tell stories faster." Because I think I rambled a lot, and it was probably a hard lesson to hear at the time, but it taught me to be a little more like, I loved talking to people. I loved kind of trying to make the adults in the room laugh. And when I was a kid, it was all adults. But it was it was one of the first notes of like, you can't go on forever. You got to have a point. Because I think like a kid, I would just kind of talk and talk and talk. And so my mom compassionately was like, "You got to pick up the pace with this. We're getting some bad feedback from your older brother and sister." So I think that directly leads to now, where I still love trying to make a group of people laugh. And I've gotten used to hearing feedback of when the adjustments need to be made.
Right. Sometimes sort of like the most sort of horrible note I think you can get as an actor or give as a director is louder, faster, funnier. But sometimes like that's the only thing to say. And so like I've sort of appreciated it in my older age. But I think it can be a great note for a young sort of storyteller or anyone, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I've learned, I think the worst reaction you can get is not even like boo, or if someone's like displeased, but more like, huh, or just confusion, because then you've missed them entirely.
Yes.
Like, I've been in shows where the audience is not happy for a moment, but if you can acknowledge that and kind of meet them, you still have them. They're still with you. If it's like, "What? Why are you doing this?" That's heartbreaking.
Because then it's almost like, no return.
I don't care what you're talking about anymore. It's like they probably want to leave.
Gotcha. I have to ask, just because I saw it on your bio, when I was in high school, right, people would talk about this sort of fabled place that I believe was Hampshire College with no grades. It was like no grades. It seemed like this sort of crazy artistic paradise. Was it that, or was the 14-year-old, did I receive wrong information when I was 14?
No, I'm happy to tell you and your 14-year-old self it was all of that. It was a lot of sort of what you brought to it. You did have to have a thing you were trying to do. It was an easy place, I think, to like creatively and academically flounder because it was like, do what you want. But then somewhere around year two, you would have like an advisory panel say, like, so what are you doing exactly? But I was applying to schools. I was kind of whining to my guidance counselor about like, I feel like I'm being kind of, just like a peg put in a slot. And she was like, I know where you should go. And she had just attended some conference where Hampshire was there. And even from their application, I was like, oh, this is where I really want to go. Because it was pretty much send us anything, whatever you think represents you creatively. And I was, in retrospect, I think I was probably like many creative high school students, but I had a lot of like essays I'd written and drawings and this and that. And it was really, I found it really cool that they were like, send us all of that. And I applied like early decision. That's where I went. And yes, there are moments, it was at times stressful because they really kind of look to you, to say like, what do you want to do here? But I mean, I found it to be really good preparation for the real world where, you don't have people saying like, this is what you're going to do for a year. There was just a lot of autonomy. There were many magical moments of like, one of the messages was like, what you want to do, there's room for that in the world. You might not always get paid for it. And if you can't find somewhere that will help you do it, find a way to do it yourself. Like I really took all those lessons to heart.
That's amazing. Your degree is in writing and animation. How did you find your way to the Second City?
So right away I went to San Francisco after college, really because I had a friend that was living there in an illegal apartment over a church because the priest didn't want to live there. There was no heat, and my bedroom was right over the organ. So I woke up at 7 a.m. on Sunday, like it or not. But she was like, it's an awesome city, come out and try it. And right after that, because yeah, I had gotten a degree in animation, I got a job in Berkeley. With this is like a million years ago, there was a screensaver company that made a screensaver with flying toasters in it. This is back during what feels like a million years ago when people paid for screensavers. But it was that company, they had kind of a comedy edge to it. They liked their products to be sort of funny. And they eventually, so I got hired there. They had a like a sister company in Chicago called Jellyvision at the time. And the two of them together worked to make a game called Hunter No Jack. Sorry, that's my, I don't know if you can hear my dog barking. Rooster just, a car went past the house. They had a sister company in Chicago, and I'd always known about the Second City. And looking back, I don't even know how. I think I knew that a lot of Saturday Night Live people had come from there. It really just kind of found its way into my brain, and I had always wanted to study there. And therefore live in Chicago along with that. And when Berkeley Systems was working with this company, Jellyvision in Chicago, I just asked, can I work in that office instead of this one? And went there and started taking classes. And that's like what led to working with the Second City. But I look back, I don't remember how I first heard about the Second City. I have a friend that is raising like a 4-year-old boy. And she said, I don't know how they find out about Star Wars. I never told him about Star Wars. They just like find their way to it. And now he's all about lightsabers. And so I think like for a comedy person, it feels similar. You just know. And I know that I think like Chicago is changing as far as like the only place you can study comedy. But at the time, for me, like the early 90s, it was like Chicago or bust if you wanted to do especially like improv comedy stuff. It was Chicago. And so that's how I found my way there.
So, you worked your way up through the Second City. You performed with them. What's one of the biggest lessons that you took away from your performance work with them?
Any like bits of ego I may have had around like choices on stage or especially writing, it just gets pummeled out of you in a good way. You stop being precious about, I would labor on scenes and sketches, and sometimes they would do great. Sometimes the thing I was saying earlier about an audience just meeting it with, why are you telling us this? But after a while, it just like, you harden around that like disappointment or whatever kind of hurt feelings you're gonna have. I found that like I can't be this stressed every time something doesn't do well. You just kind of get to the next thing. So both in terms of improv and writing, the great thing with Second City is you have access to audiences constantly. When you're doing like one of their resident stages, most nights there are improv sets afterwards. It's kind of one of their things that they pride themselves on. After you do the written show, they tend to do a third act that's just improvised. And a lot of times, I think, I don't know if this happens these days, but students that may not want to, slap down whatever money they were charging for the main show, they would let anyone come and watch the improv. And way back when, you're watching legends. This is like you can go and watch Steve Carell and Steve Colbert goof around for half an hour as many times as you like, as many days of the week. Like, so I think it's a cool thing that they still, I believe they still don't charge for that. But also, if you're on stage, you get 200, 300 people giving you feedback on your ideas nightly. And sometimes that feedback is not what you were hoping for. But that's the thing. You stop mourning your precious idea and you get back to, great, how can I change this? Or how can I throw this out completely and do something else? So I really am happy with that process. And I know that like you walk out of that building, it would take a lot for an audience to hurt my feelings at this point. It's like, because also, they're not, it's they're not judging you as a person. They're saying this thing that you thought was funny, eh, not so much. And then you go on and do something else.
You've also done improvised Shakespeare and improvised musicals. Can you talk a little bit about the courage it takes to kind of not only sort of be improvising, but also improvising in specific genres?
Yeah, I just finished the Improvised Shakespeare Company is doing an extended run with the Denver Center for Performing Arts right now. So if anyone's listening to this, and are in the Denver area, I know it's not around the corner from Buffalo, but they're there right now. And when I was first asked to perform with them, the person that created the group was named is named Blaine Swenn. And I said, and he's like a Shakespearean scholar. I believe he may have gotten a doctorate or a master's degree in Shakespeare. And I said, I don't have the volumes of knowledge that you do. I just want you to know that, which I mean is kind of bad form for an improviser in general to like apologize for your performance before going in. But I just wanted to let him know, like, hey, I might not be able to match you reference for, or even just theme for theme. And he said, just be a good improviser and the language will come, which was great advice. Be a good, and by be a good improviser, listen to people react, have something you want, have emotional stakes in the scene, really be in the scene with the other person. All of that I felt comfortable doing, because I've been doing it for a while in Chicago at that point. And he was right. Like the language just come. There kind of are easy tricks that you can do right away. Lots of like thee, thy, thou, that kind of thing. Oops, that's my husband. Sorry if you just heard the Bluey theme for a moment. That's my ringtone. So that came over time. And the other nice thing with something like Shakespeare, you're never trying to do a verbatim something that Shakespeare has written, which is liberating. It's more the themes, which are, and they kind of go in line with improv in general. Feel things deeply. You're either trying to get someone to love you, or you've fallen completely in love with someone, or you're murdering someone, or they've murdered your brother and you want revenge. It's just very epic stuff. Like, and it's good to keep those kinds of things in mind. And then honestly, steal from people that are better at it than you. Like when I came in, the group had been around for a good 5 or so years. And many of the people, I mean, some players now like Joey Bland, Ross Bryant, Brendan Dowling are all people that are like, every now and then these days they do shows in LA and like Patrick Stewart will play with them. And these are people that can kind of hold their own against Patrick Stewart because they've been doing it for so long. But I would watch what other people would do. And you kind of assemble your bag of tricks. As far as musical improv, I found that almost a little easier because, again, musicals happen in worlds where everyone feels things so deeply. There's not a lot of like, yeah, I don't know what I think about this. Like you grab the first things you can and just elevate them to the highest possible level. And that's usually when songs happen. You know, they say you sing when words just won't do your feelings justice. So those are really fun worlds to play in because the genres give you a bit of a leg up on getting to really good scenes because everything means the most it can possibly mean in both Shakespeare and musicals. So like they're both really fun mental spaces to live in because you just kind of take whatever is happening and just like turn it up to 11 and kind of stay in that. I know Blaine had another good piece of advice for like the final 10 minutes of the show where you're trying to wrap something up. He said, it's time to either get what you want or lose it forever, which is a nice way to approach. There's no small stakes in those moments. It's just like everything just goes through the roof. And it's certainly in Shakespeare, it's either you're probably heading towards a happy marriage or everyone's about to be killed, like stage full of bodies.
That's it. I mean, I'm sure they're kind of living in those circumstances night after night, kind of asking yourself, what do I want? Am I going to get it or am I going to lose it forever? Has informed your writing, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's another, like if a scene isn't quite clicking, I always look at like, well, what are people trying to do here? Even in terms of Streetcar. And the way that that was developed was with Second City, but also we knew that it was going to premiere at Writers Theater, which is in Illinois in Glencoe. It's a lovely theater. And we kind of developed it in collaboration. So they had someone, his name was Stuart Carden. I think he was their dramaturg at the time, just very knowledgeable in like, you know, the world of theater, what can help a show kind of hold together and click. And he would sometimes, like I would try some different things and he'd be like, what's happening in this scene? What are people going for right now? Not what are you setting up half an hour from now? And if there's nothing, you know, that scene probably needs to change or have something added to it or be like morphed into added to something else. So absolutely, like those rules all apply.
I have to tell you, I'm an alleyway instigator, and I directed the last one of the last plays that was up there, which was The Folks at Home. And I had a little speech during the previews where I would say, you know, the next play that's coming is Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf. And the whole audience, just the title alone, people would go like, you hear the laughter of like, of the laughter of recognition from the title, right? Were these sort of these theatrical juggernauts kind of in your consciousness? How did you come to the place where you said, I want to put the characters from Streetcar, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Death of a Salesman all in a room together?
The title came from Kelly Leonard, a Second City producer, and that's all he had. I was working there at the time and walked past his office and he said, hey, come in here, and just held it up and said, is this anything? And I was like, huh. I mean, and yeah, it's a great title. And it kind of suggests what you might be seeing. But he said, what is this? Is this a sketch show? And I said, I don't think so. I think you would want it to be a full piece because the things that you're dragging into it from different places are complete shows. And so it really was very, you know, it was created in a very like improvisational way, which is throwing around ideas and seeing what works well together. And then another writer and performer at the that was there at the time, Tim Ryder, he just said to both of us, see what this is. And very quickly we were like, well, we should deal with the shows mentioned in that title, because that really draws in a lot of classic American theater. And then we said, Our Town seems also like a good source for material for this. And then we figured out what characters would it be. You know, in the Second City world, they don't tend to create shows that have a cast of like 30. So, you know, we were like, it'll probably be five, maybe six people. They can play other roles, but we just really pieced it together bit by bit until we felt like we had enough for at least a first draft. And even from that, just from the first table read, because that Second City, their approach is usually try it out, see if it works. They go through a lot of different things that way. And many of them lead to the table read and you're like, oh, well. And that one was a lot of fun. People were laughing, and that led to like, this can be a show.
Gotcha. You know, I think your sort of game to play, if I ask a sort of a silly question here, but like, let's say you're at the Thanksgiving table and your Aunt Noreen says, you know, what's going on in Buffalo? What should I see in Buffalo? How would you describe this play to your Aunt Noreen, who's sort of an accountant?
Oh, Aunt Noreen. I mean, we dread her coming to Thanksgiving. We actually toyed around with faking some sort of family emergency, but her accountant background, she doesn't stop. The thing is, she has to solve these mysteries. So finally we said, just bring her. It's worse than trying to block her right on Thanksgiving. I would say to her, Aunt Noreen, I know that you have that accounting convention in the Buffalo area coming up. If you want to see a show that takes, imagine all of your favorite characters from classic American theater trapped in one house and trying to deal with each other on the hottest summer night in New Orleans. Doesn't that sound like a pretty good time? And ideally, you know, if she's on her third glass of rosé, I think I would say, let's go online and get you a ticket right now. Because, you know, she can be unreliable at times. So that's how we would guarantee to get her in that theater. I will say also, we tried to make the show such that you don't have to come in being familiar, you know, like having instant recall of all these shows. It is meant to lovingly celebrate them and also kind of bring everyone in on the jokes. If you're like, yeah, I think I saw that in high school, but I don't remember every last bit of it. You would still have a good time.
Gotcha. What genre would you say it is?
I think it lives in the world of classic American theater, probably amped up in a way that Second City tends to do with things that it, you know, takes on. It's everything. What did you say earlier? Louder, faster, funnier. It's certainly everything. I mean, I can't guarantee louder. Stanley Kowalski is loud, but it's the elements of those shows faster and funnier than they might happen in those shows.
What has surprised you when you've seen the work in performance?
What has surprised me is, you know, because I come from comedy, which can often be, you know, the acting that you bring to comedy is, you know, a particular type, and it's often whatever kind of gets the joke across best. But even when we began developing this show, it was, you know, like very experienced, trained actors who would bring more depth than I think at times I realized was there, you know, in the writing. They brought some great moments. So what I love the most is seeing actors take on these roles, because, you know, one of the people that has performed Blanche in Streetcar has also performed Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, which is a complicated role. Like, you have to have the chops. So to see them adjust their Blanche for Streetcar is a joy. It really is watching actors like work their craft to be like, because there are moments in our show, in Streetcar, that are very, like, it could almost be lifted a little bit from Streetcar Named Desire. Like, it's that kind of Blanche inner turmoil, you know, but then it's a comedy for us. So they're kind of then taking it a little too far. And, you know, there'll be people that are like, is this like becoming cartoonish? And it's like, in this moment, you are killing it. Like, this is what this moment needs. So I love watching people step into these roles and find their own version of these characters, you know, that is in a way the character we know and love, and in a way something new, you know, which makes it fun to see them in this situation.
What do you hope Buffalo audiences talk about on the car ride home after seeing the play?
You know, ideally, I think the dream conversation I hope would be, I want to go see the original now. Like, our play is meant to be kind of a big buffet of the things that you either remember or, you know, are inspired by from these classic shows. And if it means I am going to go back and watch this version of Streetcar Named Desire, or I forgot about that part of Our Town, I'm going to find like the PBS recording of it, I think that would be best of all. Because the show was written with a ton of love for all those shows. So if it kind of puts them back into people's minds for a little while, that's a huge win for me.
Fantastic. I have to ask, just because I'm so interested, is there anything you can tell our listeners that you're working on now that's kind of coming down the pipe for you?
I mean, here's something I can tell you that from just last week. Because it's always, so writing, animation, like I do a little bit of writing and drawing. It's always been a dream of mine to get a cartoon into the New Yorker. So I've been submitting to them for 2 years, and about 2 weeks ago, I got one accepted.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
I mean, and it's a thing where you're like, you just send them in and often it feels like you're throwing them down a well, you know, because many, many people are sending them. So I had really gotten the habit of like, it's fun to submit. Who knows if anything will ever come of that. And then I just got an email. So one of the things that happens is after they get accepted, you don't know when it's going to run. So if people listen to this and are like, it's been a few months, Tim, what happened? I can't promise when that will happen, but it seems like I have one accepted. So please look for a Tim Sniffen cartoon in the New Yorker. And I mean, fingers crossed, maybe more than one someday. The other thing, as far as like theater, the thing that I'm working on currently, just because it's a world that I think it has been really fun to live in, is a conference of children's book authors and illustrators that just gets really mean. So that's the thing that I'm working on right now. Who knows? We'll see if any theaters might be willing to give it a shot in 6 months to a year when it's done. But that's what I'm working on right now.
That sounds awesome. Listen, I could speak to you all day. You're such a joy to speak with. I always like to end my interviews by asking, is there anything that you feel left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
I mean, I'm just going to say, I'm still impressed at your interviewing chops pivot between Paul Reiser and Disney on Ice, both like really great questions. And I mean, completely different worlds. That's all I'm going to say. The thing that was unsaid during this was just me giving you props for fantastic interviews that were really lovely to listen to.
Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate that. Tim, it was great to speak with you. I hope we get to meet if you're able to come into Buffalo to see Death of Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf. I look forward to high-fiving you when I meet you.
Excellent. Thank you for your time, Daniel.
It was great chatting with Tim, and I hope you will see Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf at Alleyway Theater. The show runs April 26th through May 18th, and tickets are available at alleyway.com. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmaker engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides, posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.